All right, welcome back, everyone, to the series The Presence in the Jews, Part 24, discussing tonight the presidency of Bill Clinton, sponsored once again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Suffice it to say that Bill Clinton, the 42nd president, is one of the most complicated people ever to serve as president, a point that was compounded by the fact that his tenure coincided with the rise in the modern era, at least, of feverish, intensive media scrutiny of every politician in every aspect from which we now suffer inordinately. To be sure, Clinton was a man of prodigious appetites, food, women, and cigars, and not necessarily in that order. He's a politician who became a politician. He's never really held another job for the most natural reason imaginable. He loved policy and politics and people. And obviously, at a certain point, he realized that politics played the right way could be lucrative as well, but he was always a wonk in the truest sense. Clinton still could discourse for hours on a large variety of topics, and we take him at his word that his desire is always to improve people's lives. Bill Clinton was the first baby boomer president, and he carried with him all the charms and the flaws and the arrogance and the narcissism of that generation, of which I'm a part, and many of you as well, that essentially built nothing in American life, lived off the sacrifices of prior generations, but felt they knew better than anyone before how to build a better society and to rectify what they perceived as the errors of their forebears. Rectify they did, but at the same time, undermining the moral fiber of American society, tearing down traditional institutions and traditional morality itself, and all the while asserting a moral superiority over everyone and everything that preceded them. So for all the expenditures of the great society, poverty is the same, if not worse, the underclass is still the underclass, and certainly most recently, the American dream has been stalled, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Clinton became only the second president to be impeached. Like the first, Andrew Johnson, he was not convicted by the Senate. Unlike the Johnson impeachment, which was purely political and orchestrated by his enemies, Clinton's impeachment was not, even though it was portrayed that way, certainly by his supporters. However one looks at it, whether it was worthwhile to impeach, whether legally or politically, the fact is he committed perjury, lied under oath, and eventually paid $800,000 to settle the lawsuit against him and was disbarred for his crime. So not to impeach him would have sent a clear message that the president is above the law. And of course, that's not to say that politics was not a factor. And of course, at least half the public did not see it that way, and there was never any realistic chance he'd be convicted by the Senate, so that already becomes a purely political question of why it was done. One reason why he could never be convicted by the Senate, and half the public supported him, is because Bill Clinton is a hard man to dislike. He really is a people person. He's a natural politician who enjoyed pressing the flesh, meeting and talking to strangers, in a way that, for example, his wife Hillary is decidedly not a people person. She hated campaigning and even admitted she wasn't very good at it. She doesn't mingle well. She struggled to be charming or likable, while Bill is naturally so. Clinton writes at the very beginning of his memoirs, "I love campaigning and I love governing." And of course, note the order. There are many politicians who are like that. They prefer to campaign than they do to govern, but he enjoyed both. Another reason he retained his popularity, I've noted in the past, was because his sins or crimes were the crimes of the average person, at least the crimes the average person fantasizes about, crimes of money or sex. Nixon, who was never impeached, Nixon's crimes were crimes of power with which the average person cannot identify, but Clinton's crimes were those to which people could relate. Money scams, seducing women, etc., crimes of the flesh, as opposed to crimes of the ego. And thirdly, it needs to be said, he left office popular, he remains popular. Clinton presided over an era of relative peace and prosperity, partly because he did not hesitate at all to negotiate and compromise with Newt Gingrich, the Speaker, and the Republicans, something that at one time was obvious, but now is foolishly considered anathema and political suicide, and partly because it was all a bit of a fool's paradise. You'll often look good if you kick the can of problems down the road into the next administration. So, for sure, he benefited from the tech boom that in the late 1990s sent tax revenue soaring and helped balance the budget, and from his reluctance to do anything about Osama bin Laden, even turning down a request from the Saudis to transfer him to U.S. custody. And of course, his successor, President Bush, paid the price for both of these. The tech bust, which began late in 2000, but really took off, so to speak, or took down in 2001, sent tax revenues plummeting, and bin Laden was released from Saudi custody in the mid-90s and went back to plotting the attacks of September 11th, 2001, which occurred less than 8 months after Clinton left office. Of course, more on that next week. Even if we can't truly know what's in a person's heart, it's safe to say that Bill Clinton does not have a prejudiced bone in his body and always held reliably liberal views, and Jews loved him, and Jews still love him. American Jews in the 90s, by now deep into the throes of assimilation and the conflation of Judaism and liberalism, gave Bill Clinton 80% of their vote in 1992 and 78% in 1996. One point that deserves attention is the role and significance of character when it comes to politicians and policies. To raise the question without beating around the bush, should it matter to the citizens if a president cheats on his wife? That is to say, if he's dishonest to her, does that translate necessarily into a lack of credibility? Should it? Did it? For those who insist on a sharp demarcation between what one does in public versus one does in private, so the Clinton saga will be instructive, which is not to say society has learned its lessons, but we'll look at the intersection of character and the presidency and how that affects the world and policy and Israel and our lives as well. So Bill Clinton was born August 19th, 1946, in Hope, Arkansas, which induced the moniker, the Man from Hope, that became the title of his campaign film. He's only the second president to be born with a different name than his adult name. He was born William Jefferson Blythe III. His father, the second Blythe, was killed in a car accident a few months before he was born. Slick Road, a terrible story. He was a salesman. He ran off the road into a tree. He was also a bigamist, Bill Clinton's natural biological father. He was still married to one woman when he married Clinton's mother, Virginia, in 1943. But the South is different. When Virginia's mother married Roger Clinton Sr. in 1950, Roger Clinton adopted Bill, who then became Bill Clinton. I think when he was a teenager, he really decided to formally, officially change his name. And one thing that Bill remembered about both families, the Blythes and the Clintons, is that they treated all people fairly, and they did not believe in nor follow the laws and customs of segregation then prevailing in the South. So, for example, his grandfather's, his mother's father's, grandfather's grocery store served blacks without distinction. Didn't have a separate counter or separate hours. And Clinton writes that he didn't notice until he was much older that he was the only white boy who was playing with black kids. To him, it was natural. And that also shaped his personality and his policy. It's fair to say that Bill Clinton came from a hardscrabble background. Both his biological father and his mother married four times. And his adopted father, Roger Clinton, was an abusive drunk who would beat his mother on occasion, and whom his mother divorced when Clinton was an older teen. So it's a tribute to Clinton that he triumphed over such an upbringing. And granted, his mother when William Blythe died, his mother went back to school, and he was raised in those early years. Before he was born, his mother went back to school and became a registered nurse. And she was always a very loving person. But such hardship often produces an intense desire to succeed, which he had. It could also produce an overestimation of self when one does succeed. So it breeds a sense of entitlement, which manifests itself in one's attitudes towards women, money, other people's women and other people's money, and a powerful, unshakable belief in one's rectitude. As if to say, you've overcome such hardship, then there must be something of destiny to it. So the Clinton Library in Little Rock is unique among presidential libraries. I have visited most of them, in that there's not a single admission of error, not even a doubt about the merits of a particular decision or policy. Any failure, he was quite clear, had to do with the obstinate, nasty Republicans and their political games. And not just the impeachment was brushed off as much ado about nothing, and the evil Republicans and Ken Starr and the others. No, everything, he was right, and it was only he was frustrated by the pettiness of others. And the truth is, his autobiography is the same way. My Life by Bill Clinton. No doubts, no hesitations, no mistakes. Every other presidential library I visited contains admissions of doubts, failures, mistakes, things that were tried that didn't work, and things that should have been tried but were not. But Clinton had an almost mystical belief that what he was doing was always right. And at the time, certainly his first term, pre-internet, pre-Fox News and other outlets, it was buttressed by the mainstream media that was still then reliably liberal and naturally supportive of his policies and defensive about his errors and excesses up to a point. One other note about the entitlement mentality: Clinton was and is notorious for always being late. He would have people wait for hours at campaign stops or show up hours late for a public event while president. By contrast, George W. Bush was punctual like a Yeki. Always on time, even early. Clinton's schedule, the Secret Service used to report, was much more flexible. Clinton has one brother, Roger, who was a ne'er-do-well, later dabbled in acting. He was a lot of trouble. The Secret Service codenamed him Headache. Bill Clinton's codename was Eagle. Trump, by the way, his codename is Mogul. In the 1980s, Roger spent a year in prison for cocaine possession, and he was pardoned by his brother in the mad rush of pardons that Clinton issued in January 2001, right before his term ended, but that we'll get back to as well. So Clinton attended public school, played the saxophone, was a ladies' man. Famously, he met John F. Kennedy at the White House July 24th, 1963, as a member of the Boys Nation Youth Group, which made a deep impression on him. And he said that's what convinced him to go into public life. 1965, he writes in his memoirs, he visited New York City for the first time, 19 years old. And he was shocked to find Jew hatred. He couldn't imagine why anyone would hate anyone. How did he find out? I guess they were looking to rent an apartment. He'd gone with his mother for the summer, and he saw the leases had restrictive covenants barring sales or rentals of certain properties to Jews. He just didn't understand how that could be. After he met JFK, so he decided his career path, got a scholarship to Georgetown, graduated from the School of Foreign Service in 1968, then went to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. He's the only president ever to serve as a Rhodes Scholar, although he did not complete his degree requirements. He left after a year and parlayed that into a scholarship at Yale Law School. While at Oxford, Clinton became involved in anti-Vietnam War protests. He tried desperately to keep his deferment, and when that failed, he tried to enter the ROTC, but he wrote to them, he was rejected. He wrote in his letter to the ROTC that he's opposed to the war, but that he's submitting himself to the draft, I quote, to maintain my political viability within the system. Words that would come back to haunt him. But in the end, his birth date was selected 311 in the draft lottery, and only men that year up to 195 were drafted. So he was not drafted, and so it's unfair to call him a draft dodger. The truth is, it's unlikely the issue would have been raised but for the fact that he ran against George H.W. Bush and Bob Dole, both of whom fought bravely and were wounded in World War II. The contrast is stark, but the accusation against Clinton in this case is overblown. It was at Oxford, as he later said, that he smoked marijuana but didn't inhale. Doesn't mean he didn't enjoy, but he didn't inhale. At Yale Law School, he met Hillary Rodham. He graduated in 1973. Hillary was a year earlier, and they became an item. They lived together for a time and then married in 1975. Hillary's grandmother's second husband was a Jew, Max Rosenberg, and so through marriage, she has Jewish relatives. And in Little Rock, once they went back there and he became the governor, they befriended many Jews, and they regularly attended the Seder with them, and it was quite natural. So neither Hillary or Bill was above using vulgar racial epithets against Jews or blacks or any other ethnic group when they were angry. And both of them have volatile, quick trigger tempers, but nonetheless, it was just a blow off steam. I don't believe for a moment that Bill Clinton is prejudiced at all. Bill Clinton's a classic, like Chazal say, Noach lichos v'noach lirtzos, yotzos chor b'fseido. He's quick as he is to anger, it dissipates just as quickly in the writings of the time. See, negotiations, he would burst out and get beat red and start screaming at people, usually Netanyahu, who were not obeying his word, and then 10 seconds later it would pass and be back to a very even keel. Yotzei Schar B'Seido means that it's not a good place to be, because the advantage is overweighed by the disadvantage. You're quick to anger. By contrast, she seems to be a Noach lichos v'kosho lirtzos, quick to anger and very slow to forgive. And Chazal say that's a different attribute altogether. Interestingly, Bill Clinton, I mean, he's very focused. He did not interview for law jobs. I mean, it's coming out of Yale, it's very rare. It happens, but it's very rare. Michael Medved was their classmate, by the way, and he also didn't go into law after law school. He said he's going back to Arkansas to run for governor. All right? Indeed, he first ran for Congress in 1974, lost, ran for Attorney General and won in 1976. In the interim, he taught law at University of Arkansas Law School, and then he was elected governor in 1978, age 32, youngest governor in the nation. He remained governor until he became president, except for one term he lost in the election of 1980. And in Little Rock began this intersection of money and politics and the seeds of future scandals. Now, again, it's not fair always to look back. It seems to have been de rigueur in the South and many places in America then. So when Bill was elected governor, Hillary was hired by the Rose Law Firm, the state's largest, and it was clear that the firm received government work in exchange for her being hired, and then she profited handsomely from both connections. Soon after Bill became governor, she invested $1,000 with the head of Tyson Foods, one of the two big corporations in Arkansas, Walmart's the other, and within 10 months, that investment, so to speak, earned her $100,000. Good investment. But these are the types of insider deals that dogged both of them from the time they entered the White House, really, until today. Another deal they made was as investors in the Whitewater Project. Remember, he's governor. He invested in a project to build vacation homes on 200 acres in the Ozarks. So the project didn't succeed. If you think of the late 70s, mortgage rates were 20%, and no one was buying vacation homes. So he lost money in the project. He had given his partner, Jim McDougal, a government job, you know, while he was governor. But McDougal lost the job when Clinton lost in 1980. McDougal then created a bank, Madison Guarantee, got a ton of government money, and all that money was lost, and the government was out and had to repay $73 million. That's the Whitewater scandal. So tainted Clinton as well, and everyone in his circle. When Vince Foster, who was Bill Clinton's boyhood friend, and partner of Hillary and the Rose Law Firm, and later the first White House counsel, died of an apparent suicide in 1993. The Whitewater documents were quickly removed from his files and hidden somewhere, never to reappear. So the Clintons were never charged, but Hillary became the first lady ever to testify under oath before a criminal grand jury. In the end, 15 people were convicted, including Jim McDougal, who died in prison, and his wife Susan, whom Bill Clinton pardoned. Now, Clinton thought of running for president in 1988, but did not. Instead, he infamously gave the keynote address at the Democratic convention that nominated Michael Dukakis, a speech that droned on, and won wild applause when he said, in conclusion, something no speaker wants to hear. In conclusion, good. So Clinton set about to run for the presidency in 1992, and in retrospect, he was perfectly positioned, even if these things only become clear in retrospect. He was a Southerner, like Carter was, for example, and so could cut into what was a Republican stronghold going back to Nixon's time. He presented himself as a moderate, not a liberal, which by that time was a pejorative in American politics. And he was a leader of the Democratic Leadership Council, a moderate group. And he ought to play the game also, adjusting his policies. Like towards the end of his governorship, he became pro-death penalty because he knew that that's one of the things that had bedeviled Dukakis. And there was no obvious Democratic candidate in 1992. Several potential candidates, remember, Mario Cuomo, Bill Bradley, and others, shied away because Bush 41 was so strong and popular. After the Gulf War in 1991, Bush's favorability rating was over 90%, the highest ever. So it was assumed he would coast to victory. Never assume. Alas, the economy went into recession. Bush broke his no new taxes pledge, had to deal with a damaging primary fight against Pat Buchanan, and he began strong-arming Israel into the Madrid Conference, and then a refusal to give Israel loan guarantees to resettle Soviet Jews, except via concessions. So that turned me off George Bush, among others. So in fact, I voted for Bill Clinton in 1992 with an open mind. I have to tell you, I met Hillary Clinton in 1992. She came to Hillcrest and met four or five rabbis. At the time I was a rabbi in Kew Gardens Hills, met four or five of us. I sat 2 feet from her, asked her two questions. Both her answers turned out to be lies. I said, "What is your husband's policy on settlements?" And she looked me in the eye and said, "Settlements? We have no policy. Why would we have a policy on settlements?" A total lie, because that became the most irksome factor in Clinton's relation with Israel during his tenure. And then I asked her, "What will Jesse Jackson's role be in your administration?" And she said, "Jesse Jackson? None." And of course, Jackson became the most frequent domestic visitor to the White House during the Clinton term. The most frequent foreign visitor? Yasser Arafat. Now, additionally, in 1992, a third-party weirdo candidate emerged, the billionaire Ross Perot, and Perot won no states, but almost 20 million votes. So Clinton, in 92, won 43% of the vote to Bush's 37.5%, and the Perot factor is disputed until today. I personally believe that without Perot, Bush would have won, that Perot cut more to the Bush vote than to the Clinton vote. But Clinton more than doubled Bush in the Electoral College, 370 to 168. In 1996, Clinton defeated Bob Dole, 49 to 43%, becoming the only two-term president never to win a majority of the vote in either election, a distinction that always annoyed him. Now, during the campaign, a brutal one, Clinton had to deal for the first time with accusations of his womanizing. In fact, he was put on notice by the Bush campaign, by one of the aides, I don't want to say Bush himself was involved, that they will raise every scandal, bring up every woman if he runs. He didn't care. And the campaign was forced to deal regularly with what they called bimbo eruptions and politics headed for the gutter from which it has not yet emerged. it became clear that Clinton's cheating was just part of his personality, and no doubt for many his charm. And as governor and president, he took full advantage of his position of power. So while John Kennedy before him was shielded, the backlash had already begun, even if it had not yet reached the frenzy that it's at today. It would still vex his presidency and his legacy, and hasn't ended. What is undeniable is that the Clintons have always had an unusual marriage, what some of their friends characterize more of a partnership designed to achieve mutual goals. And it seems clear that part of the plan was to create a path to the presidency for both of them. Jews flocked to Bill Clinton, not just the population voted for him, far in excess of the general population, but he had a number of close Jewish advisors, always did. Well, actually, after Arkansas, but throughout the presidency until today, Rahm Emanuel later served with Barack Obama, now is the embattled mayor of Chicago, and Lewis, Barney Frank's sister, Jack Lewis, a special assistant, later became head of OMB. Clinton reached out to AIPAC in 1992 for briefings on Israel, and AIPAC set him up with its former staffer, Mart Indyk, who was then an Australian who became an American citizen seemingly overnight in 1993, and then Clinton was so impressed, he made him the head of the Mideast desk at the National Security Council, then he was at State, and later served two terms as the American ambassador to Israel, first Jew ever to be the American ambassador to Israel, always have been a yarmulke ceiling before them. Well, he didn't wear a yarmulke, so I need another phrase. So Indyk's become a real troublemaker, you should know, supportive of Israel, but a certain type of Israel. The one that makes endless and mindless concessions, and he's very antagonistic these days, especially to the settlements, to Israel's right-wing governments. Clinton's cabinet and staff were chock-full of Jews, and the world being a small world, many of these same people resurfaced in the Obama years as well. Treasury, Robert Rubin of Goldman Sachs, Lawrence Summers, who became the president of Harvard, forced to resign because of a true but politically incorrect statement that he made. Mickey Cantor, Robert Reich, the diminutive but outspoken economist, became Secretary of Labor. Judge Abner Mikva was a White House counsel. So this, I remember, a rabbi, I think one of my colleagues, met Mikva in the White House and said to him, "Do you know what your name means?" He had no idea what his name meant. Mikva. Imagine growing up with a name, not knowing what it meant. His daughter happened to be a reformed rabbi. Elena Kagan came to work at the Justice Department, now Supreme Court Justice. I mentioned the crafty Rahm Emanuel, the cunning Sidney Blumenthal. Sandy Berg was the NSC advisor, later convicted of stealing documents from the National Archives in his socks and destroying classified reports about terrorism plots. Madeleine Albright became UN ambassador in 1993, Secretary of State in 1997. So she was born to Jewish parents in Prague in 1937. Her father was a diplomat who converted to Catholicism, and she was raised Catholic, insisting until 1997 she had no idea of her Jewish background or that three of her grandparents were murdered in concentration camps, until told by a reporter in 1997. So it could be true, or it could be she's an extremely uncurious individual who never asked about her family, or that she's lying. One of those three. Another hidden Jew, not as dramatic a story, but raised Catholic as well, also denied that he knew he was Jewish until the late 1990s, was Richard Holbrooke. Both of Clinton's Supreme Court appointments were Jews. Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer. Dan Kurtzer became the ambassador to Egypt. Used to live here, daven here as well. He installed a kosher kitchen in Cairo, paid for by Danny Abraham of, what's that product? Slimfast. Jack Lew, I mentioned, became head of OMB. It is safe to say, in fact it's true, no president ever appointed more Jews to his administration than did Bill Clinton. And of course, the architect of Bill Clinton's triangulation strategy and 1996 campaign advisor until he was felled by scandal was Dick Morris. Now, the strategy was brilliant and successful. Essentially, Clinton took Republican and Democrat ideas and found not a middle ground, but a third way. That was the triangle, the triangulation. So you could adopt the rhetoric of one and the policies of another. So Clinton spoke as a liberal, but he governed as a centrist. Famously, he said in one State of the Union address, he declared the era of big government was over. He didn't mean it, and I'm not sure he wanted it, but for the most part, he governed like it. And part of it was political. He knew how to play the game. When his wife's health care initiative failed miserably and cost the Democrats in 1994, he basically gave it up. And then he embraced welfare reform that required recipients to work, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 that protected the public practice of religion and invalidated laws that unduly burdened religious practice. What an irony. So that law has been lambasted in the last few years, was ruled unconstitutional in 2013. That was the law under which nuns chose not to provide contraception under Obamacare, or that would enable a photographer not to work at be forced to work at a same-sex wedding, etc. That was a Democratic initiative in 1993. It wasn't a Republican initiative. It was introduced by Schumer and Kennedy. All right, times change. So too, the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, banning recognition of same-sex marriage, passed the Senate 85-14 in September 1996, was signed into law by Bill Clinton. How times have changed, and very quickly, the law was ruled unconstitutional again in 2013, 5-4, Justice Kennedy, the swing vote. So you look at Clinton's political balance sheet, and you see that whatever the eventual outcome, there's something for the right and something for the left. And that also engenders popularity. And I want to reiterate that Clinton formed a very productive working relationship with Newt Gingrich, who became the House Speaker in 1995. And together they cut taxes, they reduced the top capital gains rate from 28 to 20%. That spurred investment, especially in the new high-tech sector. While the budget was not cut substantially, tax revenues increased dramatically, and that led to the first balanced budgets for 3 years in a row, and the only balanced budgets within a 40-year span. And safe to say, we may never see another balanced budget again. So it ended with the spending increases under Bush, especially to rebuild the military, and the aftermath of the Arab terror of 9/11, and a precipitous drop in government revenue after the tech crash in 2000-2001, and then, of course, the wild Obama spending spree after 2009. It's safe to say, sadly, the Clinton years were the last time there was cooperation and a working partnership between the executive and legislative branches until today, ad va'ad bichlal, including today. And what's little remembered, though, is that when Bill Clinton left office, the economy was already in recession in 2000, and Bush inherited it, but the effects of recession are not immediately felt. Clinton and Congress also passed an anti-crime bill that funded more than 100,000 more local police officers, and that cost Hillary support in 2008, among other things, because more police officers, more arrests, increased sentences for recidivist criminals, both contributed to the stark decrease in crime that began in the 1990s, but triangulation came at a price. The Republicans won the House and the Senate in 1994, much like Obama lost the Democrat majorities already in 2010. But unlike Obama, Clinton tried to work with Republicans as whenever he could. Now, Clinton had a spiritual side as well. Baptists are often exuberant in their worship, and it fit his personality. So he connected with spiritual leaders of different faiths. And remember, he's complicated. He admired Orthodox Jews. He had a very long and cordial relationship with Joe Lieberman. Rabbi Ganak published a book a few years ago entitled Letters to President Clinton, letters that he sent on biblical themes, faith, sin, repentance, to which Clinton often responded. And not to overstate their relationship, but you could see Clinton seemed generally interested in the dialogue and the ideas, and he would incorporate them in his speeches, and he found tremendous comfort in them. And in his most trying year, 1998, after he was impeached, at the national prayer breakfast when he confessed his weaknesses, he quoted at length, it's quite moving actually, from a book called The Gates of Repentance. It's funny, Rabbi Gnack first thought it was Shari Tshuva of Rabbeinu Yonah he was quoting from, until he realized it's a Reform Yom Kippur book that's called Gates of Repentance, about notions of tshuva. But his spiritual side was real, and he respected what Jews had to offer. A number of rabbis claim close relationships with him, which evokes Chazal's statement in Avos, Hevu Zahirin Baroshus, be careful with rulers, Shem Ekarven Esa'odom El Etzor Chatzman. The rulers only bring you into their circle when they need something from you, but they don't stand with you b'shas dochaka. When you need them, they're not around. And not to mention any names, but a number of rabbis had boasted close relations with him. And in 2000, in fact, it was, I asked one of them, why don't you talk to your friend and pardon Jonathan Pollard? Ask him to pardon Pollard. And he said to me, we don't have that type of friendship. That's Hevu Zahirin Baroshus. Sometimes, you know, it works both ways. It's fair to say that Bill Clinton had a natural affinity for Jews, and he felt a special connection to Israel. He was an inveterate Bible reader, drew inspiration for it from his life, even if he admittedly fell short of the moral standards of the Bible, and it shaped, to some extent, his attitudes towards Israel. His diplomacy towards Israel reflected his desire for peace, his optimism about life and human potential, his megalomania on some level, his need for distractions from the domestic upheavals in his first and second term, and especially the influences of his key Mideast advisors, including Dennis Ross, another Jew, and Martin Indyk. In fairness, the idea that Israel could be pressured into dangerous concessions preceded Bill Clinton by about 40 years. It goes back to Eisenhower, and the Bush-Baker team applied heavy pressure on the Shamir government, which resisted and paid a steep price for it. But to be even fairer, you know, obviously the central focus of the Clinton administration in Israel was Oslo. The catastrophe of Oslo, one of the most foolish diplomatic ventures in human history, is primarily an Israeli product, not a Bill Clinton product. But it's also true that Bill Clinton didn't help much, and when the people of Israel grew tired of the terror that Oslo spawned and voted in a right-wing government to halt the surrender in 1996, U.S.-Israel relations deteriorated. Netanyahu served first 1996 to 1999, and then from 2009 on, meaning he served with Clinton and then with Obama. So it's no big shock why he said in February 2017, just 2 months ago, after Trump took office, that for the first time in his very long tenure, which is now over a decade, he feels he has an American president who has his back. And that's why relations are much improved now. But let's look at the background of Oslo and what role the Americans and Bill Clinton himself played. The negotiations between two Israeli academics and the PLO representatives that began in 1992 were illegal under Israeli law that barred meeting with PLO personnel, but pursuant to leftist dogma, leftists can violate the law when it suits them. If you're not prosecuted, so be it. Everyone else is held to its strict letter. Now, Oslo was orchestrated by Shimon Peres, even more directly by the deputy foreign minister, Yossi Beilin. Peres was a foreign minister, and began the day, the negotiations began the day, when the day Bill Clinton was sworn in, January 20, 1993, while Yitzhak Rabin was prime minister. Note, Rabin was not immediately informed that this was going on. It was behind his back, which Peres often operated. Nor did the Americans play any role in those negotiations. They were made aware of it, but they had no role for months. Among the many harmful consequences of Oslo, the terror, the death of thousands, the wounding of tens of thousands, the renunciation of Israel by Israel of its rights to its homeland, the arming and strengthening of its enemies, the whetting of the appetite of the world and the Arabs for endless Israeli concessions, etc. another consequence we're still living with was the beginning of the end of the bipartisan support for Israel in the U.S. That is to say, the slow divorce of the Democrat Party from its traditional support for Israel that crystallized in the Iran nuclear deal. All that slow divorce began under Bill Clinton. So one can hope for its return, but wishing it were so does not make it so. And obviously, a decline in Democrat support for Israel poses an existential crisis for most American Jews, who it seems will blame Israel before they blame the Democrats. But to pretend that opposition to Israel's interests is actually support for Israel is an incredible act of intellectual acrobatics. So how do we get to this point? That began in the 90s. So the main folly of Oslo, of course, was trusting the murderer Arafat, but also the asymmetry of concessions that was sought from each side. Israel was surrendering something tangible, land, in exchange for something intangible and not really needed, to wit, recognition, and something needed but not verifiable, an end to terror. So the Arafat card was one that he played very well, extracting as much as possible from Israel. The recognition, the land, the weapons, the lure of future statehood in exchange for a commitment to end terror that was breached immediately, slyly employing the facade of what they would call in the media the new unknown group claiming responsibility for an act of terror that, of course, Arafat, we now know, was masterminding. And there's no indication that Arafat ever perceived the Oslo Accords as anything but a first step that would facilitate the ultimate destruction of Israel. And plenty of evidence that he felt exactly that, including the first speech he made to an Arab audience after the Accords were signed and subsequent speeches and actions. It's clear Arafat took the Israeli government for a ride. For years, dangling promises of an end to terror in exchange for more land, freedom from more imprisoned terrorists, and more weapons. And sad to say, the Israelis were played like suckers because their fantasy of peace dominated their reason. They always pretended that peace was very near, so Peres called the victims of terror sacrifices for peace. Nothing could dissuade them. No breach of the agreement warranted its voidance. 1995, I was at the Israeli consulate in New York, and they're trying to sell the Accords, and I asked the Gad Ben-Ari, already it was terror exploding. Gad Ben-Ari was Rabin's press attaché, and I asked him while the press was breaking down this question: short of Arafat himself blowing up the Knesset, what would induce Israel to conclude that the peace process has failed? And he answered, nothing. By definition, a process can't fail. It's all part of the process. So no nation in history had ever willingly surrendered its own land to its sworn enemy and then armed that enemy. It was as mind-boggling as it was unprecedented. And so back then, I named their malady the peace idol. Like idolatry, it wasn't rational, but an emotional frenzy that denied reality. Now, one explanation used, and I want to be fair, was that peace now was indispensable because in a few years, Iran and Iraq would again be strong. They just finished their war a few years earlier. How making Israel weaker would placate Iraq and Iran remains a mystery. I put this question to Israel's ambassador to the U.S. once, and he just repeated, no, it will. I said, why would it? And he had no answer. And of course, the dissolution of the USSR, the Soviet Union, left the United States the only superpower on the globe. So Clinton felt emboldened to try to straighten out everything that was crooked in the world. By the fall, or late summer, early talks threatened to dissolve. Secretary of State Warren Christopher was dispatched to lean on both sides, but usually Israel, to concede enough to make it work. But since Israel was the only side in position to make substantive compromises, unless you consider Arafat saying, I won't murder you, a compromise, it was set up for tragedy and failure and collapse and a terrible loss of life and national morale, as if what was critical was to have enough words on paper, words vague enough that both sides would sign it at a public ceremony, and so it was. Two sides reached agreement on September 9th, 1993. On September 13th, they showed up at the White House to sign the Oslo Accords. Arafat and Rabin walked in, and Clinton said to an aide, "Miracles do happen." But then he needed some success. By then, September 93 is in his first year, he's accomplished nothing. Healthcare had floundered. NAFTA was floundering as well. It was the United States, by the way, Dennis Ross writes, it's so interesting, that insisted on that Arafat renounce terror, not the Israelis. The Americans insisted on it because by American law, they couldn't even host Arafat unless he renounced terror. Well, Rabin was very uncomfortable. As we remember, Clinton writes that Rabin did not want to shake Arafat's hand, and in fact, he did not. When they first met inside the White House, Arafat extended his hand, and Rabin kept his arms, and he said, "Outside." Neither Clinton nor Rabin wanted to kiss Arafat, who had the most to gain. So Clinton's aides taught him how to grab Arafat's right shoulder. I mean, Arafat extend his right hand, Clinton would shake him with his right hand, but at the same time, grab his right shoulder with his left hand to keep him at arm's distance, so Arafat could not come for the embrace. Even before the ceremony, the two delegations were kept apart, because when they'd been brought together, they were screaming at each other, each threatening to leave as close as 15 minutes before the ceremony, which should have been a harbinger of the disaster to come. Outside, Rabin reluctantly shook Arafat's hand, kept himself away from an embrace, and Clinton, as we recall, raised both of their hands together. It was a triumphant moment for him, less so for Rabin, who spoke eloquently about the need to end the bloodshed and the sacrifices. Arafat was less conciliatory, speaking about the beginning of the end of the injustice and recognition of the historic rights of the Palestinian people, but he offered very little, and that macabre dance had begun. Yet Bill Clinton termed what they had a remarkable working relationship, his words. And he learned, because his popularity was sinking, with the signing at the White House, it shot up. He learned every foreign policy victory helps him in the polls, and that did guide him over the next 7 years. And in the maintenance of the Oslo process and other dealings, we come to the intersection of private character and public policy, because Oslo was built, to a large extent, on lies. Now, the foundation of Oslo was reciprocity, land and rights in exchange for an end to terror and incitement, but terror increased after Oslo, and Clinton and his acolytes pressured Rabin not to void the agreement, but to continue to bribe Arafat with money, weapons, withdrawals. In effect, the signing ceremony resolved very little. It was just principles for all the hoopla, and intense negotiations began. The specifics were very different and harder to come by. It took months. The first deadline, in fact, was missed. The accord just spoke of vague language about Israeli withdrawals from Jericho and Gaza. But throughout the early process, Clinton pushed and threatened Israel. And he habitually dismissed Israeli security concerns as overblown. They missed the first deadline, December 1994, 3 months of self-rule in Jericho and Gaza. But 5 months more negotiations took place. May 4th, 1994, the PA came into existence. PLO self-rule began as an interim period of 5 years. Now, typical of the problem, the Americans got pledges of $2.4 billion for the Palestinian Authority, and they wanted Arafat to delineate where the money would be allocated, but he got angry and he said, "This is my money, and no one will tell him what to do with it." And so it was, and they just kept paying it by the billions. And the threat and reality of violence always lurked in the background and sometimes the foreground. And as we shouldn't find out, once you pay blackmail, it's very difficult and imprudent to stop. And Oslo was built on paying blackmail to Arafat. Suffice it to say, until the end of Clinton's term, he was enamored with Arafat, until in the end when Arafat betrayed him. But the duplicity was universal. Israelis were also deceived. Example, December 1994, 3 months after the accords were signed, the IDF military advocate issued a report that the PLO was not in compliance. They had more police officers than they were allowed. They made an army. They had more weapons than they were allowed. Of course, there was terror. The Rabin government just suppressed the report. At the same time, negotiations began on the Syrian track. In late 1993, Rabin told Clinton and Warren Christopher he's willing to withdraw from the Golan Heights entirely in exchange for full peace, normal relations, but not to tell Hafez al-Assad, because once Assad knows that there'll be a full withdrawal, he won't be willing to accommodate on any other issues, security, peaceful relations, etc. Of course, Christopher told Assad everything. And then for years, Assad complained, Israel committed to withdraw from the Golan and then reneged. But the Israeli position was intentionally misrepresented by Christopher to keep the peace process going. And Clinton, all right, this is a vintage Clinton, writes, or said at the time, I knew people like Assad in Arkansas, afraid of change and overly rigid because of it. I know what it takes to affect a guy like this. Sure. Already in early 1995, Arafat was giving bellicose speeches in public about martyrdom, sacrifices, and a return to all the old Arab cities in Israel, not to mention the more private speeches such as the one in South Africa, right after the accords were signed, in which Arafat pledged himself to the destruction of Israel in stages. And that too was ignored, even though Israeli leaders knew about it. They said, don't listen to what he says, but what he does. But what he did was just as bad. I quote, this is from the Johannesburg speech. The Palestinian people are prepared to sacrifice their last boy and their last girl in order to wave the Palestinian flag. Jerusalem is the capital of the state of Palestine, whether someone likes it or not. And whoever doesn't like it, let him drink from the Sea of Gaza. And if the Israelis think there's no alternative to negotiations, I swear they are wrong. This is August 6th, 1994. The leaders all knew it and intentionally ignored it and kept it from the people. Now, most Jews were euphoric, and a relative handful were opposed, disgusted, determined, and we in the latter group endeavored to combat the Oslo Accords by holding the PLO accountable. Since the PLO was living off, to a large extent, American taxpayer money, so a group of rabbis and prominent, a few other organizations, the most prominent Young Israel, Zionist Organization of America, began a campaign to link any American money to the PLO to their adherence to the agreement. Any breach, no money. Suffice it to say, most rabbis in the Israeli government vigorously opposed this effort. So I had a bit role in all of this. In June 1995, more than 100 rabbis descended on Capitol Hill to lobby Congress to pass such linkage legislation, which the Israeli government was completely opposed. I was the American co-spokesman for that group. Bizarrely, they had bought into the process that they wanted to speak of reciprocity, but have no means to enforce it. And even more strangely, we're faced with the spectacle of going to Congress and lobbying against Israel, a novelty that puzzled our hosts. I remember I was with a group of five rabbis. One was Rav Schechter. Welcome to Bill Bradley's office, who was then our senator. And we spoke about the bill, and he said, what does the Israeli government say about the bill? So I said, well, the Israeli government's opposed to the bill. And he nodded, and he said, wait, you're against the Israeli government? He couldn't compute how these rabbis could come and support such a bill the Israeli government did not want. In the end, the legislation passed, but in typical Washington fashion, it sounded good, but contained the weasel language allowing the president to certify every 6 months that the PLO was in compliance, even if they weren't. I should say, in July 1995, a month later, I met with the former chief rabbi of Avram Shapira in his home in Yerushalayim, and he told me and a colleague that our battlefields were New York and Washington, and the struggle should continue there. And it's a shame that more couldn't be done. Notwithstanding the failure of Oslo I, Clinton pressured a compliant Israel into Oslo II and a withdrawal from six cities in Judea Samaria. And that deal only passed the Knesset when Rabin bribed two members of the far right-wing Tzomet party with ministries and Mitsubishis. At the same time, he became very condescending to his opponents, both domestic and external. And you might recall I caught up in that also when the Times reported that one of our prominent members decided to resign from the shul, something I believe until today was orchestrated by the Israeli consulate in New York. Why else would the Times care? When Rabin was assassinated November 4th, 1995, Clinton was distraught, and genuinely so. He sought comfort in the Bible, and to him, the death had biblical overtones. Tragedy of the peacemaker. He flew to Israel with a large delegation, eulogized Rabin eloquently, referencing Akedas Yitzchak, which was the seder that week, Parshas Vayera, memorably ending his speech, Shalom Chaver, something that endeared him to a generation of Israelis and to American Jews forever, became a catchphrase in Israel for a decade, but Len was derided by a sardonic bumper sticker by the late 90s when terror had escalated and the death toll mounted with this, Hakol Biglalcha Chaver, it's all because of you. And worse, the process had to be constantly stoked and Arafat stroked with money, concessions, and perks to keep him from backing away. And this became a source of endless contention between the Israeli government, especially after Netanyahu became prime minister. Rabin himself became increasingly disenchanted with the way the process unfolded. A lot of mythology. Note, Rabin never committed to a Palestinian state, never committed to uproot any settlements. The arguments that he did are just mythology, and he did enough harm without accusing him falsely of supporting things that he did not support. But it's true, his policies did generate these expectations, another Oslo folly. This too was ignored. Arafat, but it's frightening when you consider how it came about. Arafat, January 30th, 1996, Stockholm, Sweden, 40 Arab diplomats. The speech was entitled The Impending Collapse of Israel, and Arafat said, and I quote, well, this you can actually listen to online if you understand Arabic, within 5 years, we will have 6 to 7 million Arabs living on the West Bank and in Jerusalem. You understand that we plan to eliminate the state of Israel and establish a purely Palestinian state. We will make life unbearable for Jews by psychological warfare and population explosion. Jews will not want to live among us Arabs. End quote. Not to mention the terror. None of this mattered to the Israeli leadership and certainly not to Clinton. Paris was defeated several months later by Netanyahu, but not before Bill Clinton actually came to Israel and effectively campaigned for Paris, trying to reassure Israelis on security. Netanyahu took office. They never got along. Never. From the get-go. Their first meeting, Netanyahu lectured Clinton about the best way to deal with the region, the Arabs. He left. Clinton said to an aide, who does he think the superpower is? He wanted a much more docile, deferential interlocutor. And in Clinton's understanding, his mind, Netanyahu was troubled because he was afraid to take risks for peace. That same month, October 1996, riots broke out in Yerushalayim when the Hashmonai tunnel opened the second entrance, really an exit into the Muslim quarter. Clinton, to his shame, writes in his memoirs that the tunnel runs under the Temple Mount, thereby provoking the Arabs. Of course, the tunnel runs adjacent to the Temple Mount now for 2,200 years. Not under, but that mistake is just slightly better than the Arab lie that the tunnel runs under Al-Aqsa and is designed to undermine it. But Clinton blamed Netanyahu and castigated him again when he announced the building of apartments in what became Har Choma, south of Yerushalayim. Mike remembers we were there to break ground in 1996. Most American Jews were oblivious to the hostility of the Clinton government to Israel. Like I said, 70% supported him in the election a few weeks later, and that itself made a lasting impression, created the dynamic that if Democrat politicians say the right things about Israel, they could do whatever they wanted to do, and that set into motion the deterioration of Democrat support for Israel that we're witnessing today. Clinton twisted Netanyahu's arm into withdrawing from Hebron early in 1997, but with his domestic house in turmoil, Clinton was nearing impeachment in 1998, Clinton sought another diplomatic victory for the fifth anniversary of Oslo. So without belaboring the point, the Jew who will always be most associated with Bill Clinton is Monica Lewinsky. But it's interesting that when Clinton wagged his finger and lied about doing anything inappropriate with her, Netanyahu was either in the White House or just left the White House. So right before that, Clinton was pressuring Netanyahu, and right after that, he was negotiating with Arafat. He was always there. I think he visited America too much, Netanyahu. He'd be summoned to withdraw, to surrender, to release more prisoners, not to respond to terror. Sometimes he would agree and then get back to Israel and retract. Sometimes the cabinet refused to go along. It was always unpleasant, and he soon perceived the Clinton administration as, in his words, pro-Palestinian. With the process floundering and the Netanyahu government itself collapsing for several reasons, including the troubled relations with the U.S., and the inability to have a coherent policy moving forward, and with Clinton in need of a distraction, he determined to have a summit and another signing ceremony that would involve a further withdrawal of Israel from 13% of Judea Samaria. You could just distribute these just to see the difference between the withdrawal after Oslo in 95. The black area is what Rabin gave up, and on the other side, what Netanyahu was forced to give up at Y, a much more extensive black area. So just hand these out, and you can keep them if you want. Just to look at both sides, you see the transformation. You see as well how it's impossible, it's not credible that such inkblots could function not only not as a state, but even as a political entity, because there's no contiguity. It's as if they one side never anticipated it would happen, and the other side didn't even insist that it would happen. That's how bizarre it looks. Well, this ceremony became the Y Accords, negotiated in Maryland. Netanyahu did not want to go. His government was in danger of falling, but in May of that year, the 50th Yom HaTzmut, Al Gore came to Israel, scolded Netanyahu for quibbling over land. Later, Albright said that if Netanyahu does not agree to come, he'd be blamed for the catastrophe, her word, of the failure of the peace process. And all Arafat ever had to do was promise the same things again and again. And meanwhile, he too was threatening just to declare statehood within 1 year. He knew Bill Clinton would be able to deliver Israel. By the way, the whole administration, the worst to Israel, the worst were Madeleine Albright and Sandy Berger. Netanyahu again demanded that the PLO charter be revised to abandon its commitment to destroy Israel, something negotiated three times before and not done. He demanded U.S. support against PLO terror, but the Americans were obsessed with only one thing. The only thing that was tangible, Israeli withdrawal, because that's loss of land. You could photograph it on television, the withdrawal of forces. And it gets even worse. Over the summer, Netanyahu agreed to a 10% withdrawal. He told his cabinet he would not budge. And then he agreed that 3% would be a nature reservation. He asked Clinton to keep this confidence. Clinton had Indyke leak this to defense minister Itzik Mordechai. That caused a cabinet price. Netanyahu was not telling the truth. In May of that year, at a Nakba conference, imagine, Clinton came, addressed the Arab American University graduates, a conference to mark the catastrophe, the creation of the state of Israel, and under a banner that read, 50 years of usurpation, Clinton told the crowd, we will win. The next day, the PA newspaper, Al-Hayal Jadida, crowed that this represented the collapse of what they called Jewish control over America. And then Clinton abandoned the 10 plus 3% withdrawal, insisted on a full 13%. That's what Arafat wanted. Netanyahu, that was when he came, spoke before Congress. I was there also that day. Tremendous support from Congress, and that further angered Bill Clinton. And Clinton was a master negotiator. Ross writes in his memoirs, Clinton had an amazing capacity to convince each side that he was in its corner. But you only get to do that if you're lying to one or both. And now we come to this interesting vignette. Netanyahu was cajoled to come, and there are two different tales about the Jonathan Pollard connection. Clinton writes very innocently And that after the deal was reached, I quote now, there was one more obstacle. Netanyahu was threatening to scuttle the whole deal unless I released Pollard. Note his language. He said I had promised him I would do so at an earlier meeting the night before, and that's why he agreed to the other issues. In fact, I told the Prime Minister that if that's what it took to make peace, I was inclined to do it, but I would have to check with our people. Netanyahu felt he'd be better able to sell the new concessions to the public, especially the right-wing public, if Pollard came home with him, and now the rug was pulled out from under him. All right, name drop warning. In the early 2000s, I met Netanyahu, and I asked him what happened and why. And he said to me simply four words. I still hear them echoing in my ears. Clinton lied to me. And then he explained what happened. He said Clinton promised first if Netanyahu came to Y, and then they reached the deal, he could leave with Pollard. And he reiterated during the negotiations that Pollard would be freed if they came to an agreement. So in fact, Netanyahu gave more, conceded more than he otherwise would have on the premise that Pollard was coming back to Israel with him. At 3 a.m., Netanyahu agreed to the deal. The last hangar was more prisoners would be released. He asked when Pollard would be delivered. Clinton said, I'll get back to you. 6:30 a.m., Clinton said to Netanyahu, he's telling me just what he told me. Sorry, he checked with his people. It can't be done. George Tenet, head of the CIA, no friend of Israel, said he'd resign if Bill Clinton freed Jonathan Pollard. Just flick the light. I don't want to leave him too much suspense. Dennis Ross urged him to save Pollard for a future deal, not release him now for final status negotiations. Pollard was too valuable a bargaining chip to be released just for this. Netanyahu told me he went back to his room, prepared to leave. He discussed the matter with Ariel Sharon, who was now his foreign minister. He was threatened by Clinton that he'd be blamed for the breakdown in U.S.-Israel relations. Weighing everything, remember it happened at 6:30, at 2 p.m., Netanyahu caved. And he said he signed the deal, and he was very gracious to Clinton in public for negotiating it. But I'll never forget those words. Clinton lied to me, and we need not speculate too much that one who would lie to his wife and to a grand jury could also lie in high-stakes political negotiations. In typical fashion, the withdrawal was eventually carried out with much dissent and the eventual dissolution of the Netanyahu government. When Netanyahu returned to Israel to soften the Y blow, that's when he announced the tenders for construction on Har Chomah. So it's the same game he's playing 20 years later. A concession and then an attempt to mollify the right wing with some building. December 14th, 1998, 5 days before the House voted to impeach Bill Clinton, I repeat that, 5 days before the impeachment, Clinton presided over a session of the Palestine National Council in Gaza, where by a show of hands, they purported to revoke their genocidal charter. Of course, it was all a farce. The charter provides details on how it's to be amended. It's like people in a room voting to amend the American Constitution. No, it's much more formal than that. The PLO media denied anything had changed, but Clinton wanted the optics and got it. 2 days later, seeking another distraction, Clinton launched 600 bombs on Iraqi targets that caused a ruckus but little damage. Wag the dog. December 19th, 1998, he was impeached. By this time, Clinton had tired Netanyahu, and when the Knesset called for elections to take place in early 1999, Clinton was not shy about supporting Ehud Barak. And I must say, for all the Democrat complaints these days about Putin and collusion and the 2016 elections, the phoniness and the hypocrisy are stunning. Talk of interference. In 1999, the Labour Party hired, obviously with Clinton's blessing, Clinton's whole campaign team, James Carville, Stanley Greenberg, Bob Schrum, to run their election campaign. It was open, explicit, and blatant interference in Israel's election, even more than Clinton had done in 96 for Peres, and it worked. Even more, millions of dollars were given to the Labour Party from American sources, all untraceable. The Labour money man was a young lawyer named Buzi Herzog, who was investigated, pleaded the Israeli version of the Fifth Amendment, but never indicted for lack of evidence. In 2015, just to update it a little, Obama pulled the same stunt in a craftier way. Another Israeli election. Funneled tens of millions of dollars, some for the State Department, to an organization called V15, Victory in 2015, headed by Jeremy Byrd, who was Obama's former national campaign director, was based in Israel and dedicated to Netanyahu's defeat and to Buzi Herzog's election. As they should spare us the fake outrage over Putin, because America does it in every democracy. They can't do it to Putin because he's a dictator, doesn't stand for election. But nonetheless, in July 1999, Barak replaced Netanyahu. In the fall, Hillary came to Israel, visited Ramallah, and infamously sat through a speech by Sua Arafat, in which Arafat's wife claimed that Israel was daily, systematically using poison gas against Palestinian women and children. Hillary sat impassively, then embraced and kissed Sua after the speech. She later claimed she didn't know what was being said. When she found out later that day, she refused to condemn it, merely noting that this is why the president has urged, quote, the parties to refrain from making inflammatory charges or engaging in excessive rhetoric, end quote, as if Israel had done the same thing. So when Barak was elected, Clinton again had a partner to work with. Fortunately, their partnership did not last long, so we're almost finished. But Clinton had a partner to work with. Barak recklessly fled Lebanon, allowing Hezbollah to take over the south. That's provoked two conflicts since, with high casualties and enormous damage, as well as the abandonment of Israel's Christian allies. But most famously, at Camp David in July 2000, Clinton tried to force Barak and Arafat into one final deal, and Barak basically conceded everything, 97% of the land, look at the map, a division of Yerushalayim, Arab sovereignty over Har HaBayit, and Arafat still refused. Among other things, Arafat refused to waive the right of return or any Jewish presence in the Old City, and still many White House and state Arabists refused to blame Arafat. They blamed Barak, or at least they split the blame. By this time, Arafat had already made plans to launch the terror war that began in September, just 2 months later, in an attempt, as he laid out at Stockholm, to dispirit and debilitate the Israeli people. And there were thousands of casualties in that two-year-plus war that ended only with Operation Chomat Magen and the Israeli army reoccupying the cities it had surrendered during the Oslo fiasco. The IDF remains there in one form or another until today. Clinton made one final desperate attempt in January 2001. Barak was already presiding over minority government. Israelis had called for new elections. He'd be ousted from office in February in a landslide defeat. And he made even more concessions that he was in no moral or political position to make. But Arafat held firm. Angry Clinton pushed and pushed. Arafat resisted. In their last exchange as president, Arafat said to Clinton, "You are a great man." And then Clinton exploded. "I'm a colossal failure, and you made me one." Ross wrote that it seemed that Arafat was always committed to the one-state solution, only Palestine. Duh. Clinton told George W. Bush on January 20th that the biggest mistake he made as president was trusting Arafat. Double duh. Well, just to summarize, Clinton was bedeviled by one scandal or another during his tenure. It's not surprising he left office enmeshed in more scandals. He had to admit to testifying falsely, was disbarred. He paid Paula Jones $800,000 to go away quietly. He made reckless use of the White House, extracting money from donors for every conceivable reason, including renting out the Lincoln bedroom. He pardoned the FALN terrorists to help his wife with Puerto Rican voters in our New York Senate campaign, and again Tenet threatened to resign, and Clinton then released the terrorists anyway and said, "Okay, resign." And Tenet said, "All right, I won't." He pardoned Mark Rich in exchange for money from Rich's ex-wife of the Clinton Library, and then he turned the White House and the promise of future benefits into a cash cow that eventually became the Clinton Foundation that haunted his wife's campaign. And now that the campaign is over and the quid has no quo, it seems that the Clinton Foundation donations have dried up and the operation seems to be winding down. And of course, Jonathan Pollard was not pardoned, despite requests from friendly Jews. Apparently there was no money in it, and those Jews were not as, or votes, and there was no, the Jews were not as good friends as they thought they were. What fascinates is that all these things skirt the edge of illegality, but Clinton has always remained popular in the bad boy, roguish sort of way. And that was his charm, which continues until today. I see him as a person with a good heart, great political instincts, a natural affinity for people, including Jews, a desire to serve and do good in the world, but with a sense of entitlement that led him to live life on the edge, take risks, assume he always knows what's best for everyone, and that could eventuate in vindictiveness. If his presidency is judged on its 8 years alone, so his results are relatively good, peace and prosperity, but his administration kicked some cans across that bridge to the 21st century that would explode in rage and horror on September 11th, 2001, and thereafter. And for all his professed love of Israel, Israel was weaker and more demoralized in 2001 when Clinton left office than in 1993 when he entered office. And like many presidencies, it will take at least 50 years to evaluate the consequences of what Bill Clinton did and did not do during his 8 years as president. I thank you all very much. Next week, we'll look at the 43rd president, George W. Bush. Thank you all for coming. All right.